Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is an MCRIT We. Today on the podcast, Ross Prager, intensivist and educator and researcher who has been putting out some amazing tweetorials on Twitter, or I guess if you're forced to call it X, though how friggin' ridiculous a name. I mean, just every piece of the transition, just so friggin' stupid. But be that as it may, Ross is doing great work on Twitter. Follow him. Ross_Prager, because he's putting out great education. He did a tutorial on tenuristics he learned at the nascent portion of his career in intensive care. And I said, come on the podcast and let's discuss them. So he did. And that's what you're going to hear today. And it's great. Before we get there, two quick plugs. One, Flameproof Course, our anti-burnout course I do with my coaching partner, Rob Orman of the Stimulus Podcast. And we've now run through two cohorts of this, and it's been amazing. You will learn how to deal with your inner voice, how to find agency in your career in emergency medicine or critical care, how to deal with interruptions, how to deal with bad consultants, how to communicate, how to meditate, how to sleep, all sorts of good things that will make you more resilient, more burnout protected, and therefore flame-proof. Now, if you're already burnt out, this will help. If you're worried about your career going down the wrong direction and you losing joy, this will help. Go to flameproofcourse.com. Flameproof Course, all one word, flameproofcourse.com. And two-second plug, Reanimate, our resuscitative ECMO course in November of 2024 in San Diego. It sells out every year. We've sold a bunch of tickets. We are getting low. If you are interested in taking this course, come get your tickets now, reanimateconference.com. All right, with that all said, let's get to Ross Prager on heuristics for the new ICU attending. And this is just as applicable to ED attendings doing resuscitation. So do not stop listening if you're not ICU. This is just as relevant to critical care in the ED and out of hospital for the most part as well. Okay, let's do it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, my name is Ross Prager. I'm an intensivist in London, Ontario. Not the proper London, but still a great place to be. And I'm a kind of early clinical researcher, but interested in medical education, knowledge translation, and how we can translate evidence into practice. So just thanks for having me.
Yeah, I love it. And you've been posting some great stuff on Twitter. If people like this kind of critical care knowledge, they should follow you for sure. And you had a post of the heuristics you have discovered as a critical care person at the beginning of their career. And these are some of the things that I imagine either you watched other people get burned, maybe you got burned yourself, or you just derived them from your experience of how I could get burned. But tell us a little bit about why you made this post.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. These are some things that I've experienced even early on in my career, and certainly things I've witnessed. And I think in general, there's so much information that we get in the intensive care unit and trying to filter that out. And sometimes you just need heuristics and kind of stop points in your mind that say, if this is going on, let's take a step back and enter that kind of system two thinking. And these were just some of my early observations and experiences.
I love it. All right, so we're going to go through them one by one. You'll tell us a little bit about your thoughts. I'll add in my opinions, and then we could go through them. So let's start off with POCUS for narrow pulse pressure shock.
Absolutely. So narrow pulse pressure is really a surrogate for stroke volume. And this comes out of the trauma literature in part, also the sepsis literature. The Andromeda Shock 2 randomized controlled trial actually uses pulse pressure as one of the early branch points in the resuscitation protocol. And you might say, shouldn't we be doing POCUS for everyone? Well, if you're in a busy emergency department and intensive care unit, you have to triage these things a little bit. And these patients with narrow pulse pressure, they could have the unexpected causes of shock. They could have pericardial fusions, left or right ventricular failure, hypovolemia, whereas the wide pulse pressure shock is much more likely to be distributive.
Yeah, no, I love that a lot, because what it really says is something is impinging cardiac output, as opposed to, as you say, vasodilatory shock. All right, they should definitely get a rush exam at some point, but chances are it's probably not going to show you too much that you're not expecting. But on the other hand, narrow pulse pressure shock is an unexpected finding. Something is going on to diminish this patient's cardiac output. And so a multifactorial POCUS should reveal a source. Now, that source might be hypovolemia, in which you have to infer rather than having definitive evidence. But if you wind up seeing a pericardial tamponade, and we've all had these cases where it was just missed for way too long, that's going to be a absolutely care-changing moment. So I like that. All right. Yes, do rush on any hypotension, but especially have the alacrity in patients with narrow pulse pressure. All right. Persistent hypovolemia equals possible dynamic LVOT obstruction. Tell us about that.
Yeah. And so when you have a non-bleeding patient who's behaving persistently hypovolemic despite fluid resuscitation, consider dynamic LVOT obstruction. And part of this comes from the fact that rates of fluid responsiveness decrease dramatically when you're in the intensive care unit. So early on in sepsis resuscitation, most patients are fluid responsive. And we saw this in Andromeda Shock randomized controlled trial. As we progress into the intensive care unit, or even after 8 hours of resuscitation, this number goes down to 10, 20%. And so if a non-bleeding patient has 6 liters of blood volume and you've given them like 6 liters of crystalloid already, and they're still behaving hypovolemic, I always want to think, could this be LVOT obstruction? And you might think, is this just hokum patients? It can actually happen in any critically ill patient with the right physiologic milieu. And these are patients with low afterload, potentially relative hypovolemia, increased adrenergic tone or inotropy. And most of these patients respond just to a bit of fluids, maybe that you switch their vasopressors from norepinephrine, or maybe they were on epinephrine if they were really getting crashing, switch them on to phenylephrine or vasopressin. But some of these patients actually need esmolol. We actually looked at 54 acute trauma resuscitations with TEE here in London, and we found 3 cases of dynamic LVOT obstruction in the midst of trauma resuscitation in the trauma bay or very early ICU course that required therapy like esmolol. And so I think if you're looking for this and considering this as an etiology, I think we'll find it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Where I've discovered it is you have these older women, and I don't know why, maybe you have some inference as to why the predominance is in older women with the systolic anterior motion, and they get a little bit of tachycardia and their hemodynamics go to crap. And yeah, the natural inclination of some people would be, oh, let's just give them more fluid. And that's actually not the way to go. They need their heart rate slowed down. So how are you looking for this on ultrasound? What is your windows of choice, and what is actually prompting you to go further than just an initial TTE examination of what I imagine? What will you tell us? What's your ultrasound examination for this patient?
Absolutely. So it's really any view you can get. And the first thing I look for is whether or not the patient has a hyperdynamic LV. One of the reasons I wonder whether or not you're seeing this more in kind of more elderly patients is the concomitant diastolic dysfunction. They're requiring higher filling pressures to actually fill. But if the patient's vasoplegic, for example, their end diastolic volume is going to be a little bit lower. And that's part of the substrate for LVOT obstruction. So once I've identified a patient that has a hyperdynamic LV, I then like to screen with color over the LVOT. You see aliasing of that solar Doppler as we're heading out the LVOT. Next, I want to put a pulse wave on the LVOT. And can I actually resolve the envelope of the VTI? Because if I can't actually see the VTI, it's going off the scale. It's another good indicator of potential LVOT obstruction. And then the kicker is really continuous wave Doppler, hopefully from like an apical 4, apical 5 chamber. And if that continuous wave Doppler has a high velocity or that kind of classic dagger shape that we see, then that's the cincher that there is an intracavitary gradient or dynamic LVOT obstruction.
Yeah, and that really hits it from people who have, I think, good experience with echocardiography. What if you had someone who is, they could do the basics. They're not going to touch Doppler. They're not going to touch anything beyond that. They really have just learned their 4-view cardiac series to look for things like tamponade and maybe some generalized cardiac output. What clues would there be? Hey, maybe I should get someone more clever at ultrasound to the bedside to take an examination. Are there any that you'd see just on standard mode ultrasound?
Yeah, I think the 2D examination of the mitral valve and looking at that anterior leaflet, is there that kind of stromotion that you're seeing compared with normal? And it takes a little bit of time to train your eyes, but even on 2D, you can sometimes see this. The second is actually with the patient's vitals. I've seen a couple cases of LVOT obstruction where there's this big swing in the map and the heart rate. The heart rate is going between 110 and 150, and it almost looks like they're going into an SVT, but it's actually sinus throughout. And this hyper-exaggerated pulse pressure variation and heart rate variation, there seems to be an association between that and the physiology at play. Potentially, as the patient's heart rate is going faster, their end diastolic volume gets worse and worse. Eventually, their cardiac output goes down and then they start filling, and it creates a cyclical motion. And so I wonder whether that would be something else that I'd want somebody to take a look at.
Yeah, it almost feels like chugging on an ECMO circuit where you have that shaking and then eventually it gets sucked into the venous cannula and then it resets because they've had a temporary lapse and it feels of that same ilk. All right. Anything else on LVOTO?
I think that the only thing I'd say is that it's not something that is just like this niche diagnosis. I think as we start doing more and more critical care echoes on people, we're starting to see this physiology at play in many patients. I think most of the time, the treatment's just a bit more fluids, there's not really a specific therapy, but as these patients get sicker and sicker, I think sometimes having a bit more nuanced management approach is really valuable.
Yeah, it seems like this should be the next one up on your little research cadre's paper publications, because this would fit in nicely with all the other great stuff you guys are doing. All right. The nurse asking the same question twice. This is a shift from the purely clinical to now the interactions of teams. So tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah. And I think this really comes from if a colleague, team member, allied health, really anyone asks you the same question twice, it's worth just having a pause and trying to understand how they're conceptualizing the problem, because this may be that they're concerned about something and just visually or considering the problem in a way that you aren't. And so I just try to ask why whenever I can. And I've had cases where you're like, oh, wow, like, great, I wasn't even thinking about that. But yeah, we should be considering that. And it can really change your management. And just it really also supports, I think, the team bringing up ideas and concerns, because there's so many eyes, so many ears in the intensive care unit, emergency department, that we want to make sure we're getting all the information from everywhere we can.
Yeah, absolutely. Jenny Rudolph did some great work on this. And she's like, when you start thinking, what the fuck, to change that WTF to what's their frame? Because that is the key, because obviously they are, as you alluded to, seeing things differently. Now, I'd go a step beyond that and say, when you have that nurse who you've already pegged, yeah, they usually come to me with nothing. And you blow them off once. Okay. You blow them off twice. And now what's going to be remembered is not the 999 times that you're intuition was absolutely correct, and it was indeed nothing. What's going to be remembered is the 1 out of 1,000 where you completely blew it, and they were actually telling you something real. That one will be remembered, and none of the context of the other 999 times will be there. So it just behooves you to just at least give the external manifestations of concern, regardless of what's going on internally. Because what you want to be is, oh, they take me seriously. Because if you get the impression out there, oh, he's blowing me off, and the one time they're right, it's just going to destroy you. They're going to do everything possible to burn you down, because and they should, because you did not give them the regard for them. And now, look, you could do education, right? You could go to the bedside with a nurse, or it doesn't have to be a nurse. I've seen this with other colleagues, physicians, and just say, show me what you're seeing. And then you could give your rationale for why not. And maybe that will influence. But just being like, anything disdainful is just pure danger. And many of us have learned this from witnessing colleagues destroyed when they finally have gotten their comeuppance. There you go. All right. Septic shock does not equal distributive shock.
Yeah. I think this is so important that a patient with septic shock can have any phenotype of shock that they want. The RV failure with acute core pulmonale, they could have a pericardial effusion, it could be hypovolemic, or they could have distributive shock. And if they have distributive shock, they could be fluid responsive or fluid unresponsive. It could be fluid tolerant or fluid intolerant, and they could have venous congestion or no venous congestion. And so separating the diagnosis of sepsis itself from the etiology of shock allows you to conceptualize those two issues differently or separately and really manage them and approach them differently.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the podcast coming out this week is the paper you folks just did on the classifying patients, primarily with sepsis, into the Diamond-Forrester classification shows they could be anywhere. And your hemodynamic management is going to be completely different on an individual patient basis. And I know what you're going to say. Without ultrasound, you just can't figure it out. I imagine this is another category of patients that very soon on and then continuously reassessing, you're using ultrasound to determine where to go. Is that correct?
It is correct, but maybe... And you know what, I'm a huge ultrasound proponent, but as a kind of investigator on the Andromeda Shock 2 team as well, the idea is how can we phenotype resuscitation beyond just relying on ultrasound? And for example, in Andromeda Shock 2, there's other clinical markers we're using. So we're looking at things like pulse pressure, diastolic pressure, different physiologic parameters that are perhaps more readily available to help phenotype shock. And then potentially using other markers of fluid responsiveness like pulse pressure variation on an ART line to decide whether or not patients are responding to fluid. So I'm a huge proponent of focus, but I'm also a huge proponent of bedside assessment of microcirculatory health and integrating that.
Yeah, I love that. Now, if you are using pulse pressure variation on your ART line, and this is a tangent, but I think it's worth pursuing, are you primarily leaving patients on modes that are not encouraging spontaneous ventilation, or are you just trying to go that one step further and thinking you can do pulse pressure variation on patients with spontaneous efforts?
Yeah, I think ideally, and certainly the evidence base is stronger for patients who are on those control ventilations, but I find that there's still clinical value even in patients that are not on those strict control modes. I don't think I would want to sedate somebody more heavily to get this measurement, because I think the risks of increased sedation and kind of moving in that direction just to get this metric probably aren't worth it. But I do use it more liberally than the strict definition.
I think as do we all. You look up and you see huge changes. You're like, yeah, it probably means something. All right. Sepsis, not yet determined, should rarely be diagnosed in the ICU. I assume that's what you mean by NYD, right?
Correct. Yeah, I don't know. If you're sick enough to be in the intensive care unit, you're really sick enough to have a full workup. And in the case of sepsis, we know that source control is just so important. And if this patient, if we don't have a source of sepsis, I think we need to go looking. Is this pan CT scanning, goal-directed echo, goal-directed TEE? And really repeating the primary history from the family member, from the best source, from the patient, if they're able to really find that localizing symptom and diving deep into that. It really makes me worried when you have a patient in the ICU for 24, 48 hours and you don't know the source of their sepsis. But I just worry that there might be a specific treatment or source control that we're missing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's time to start doing the detective work, checking every inch of skin, thinking about weird things like sinuses, as you mentioned, endocarditis, all of that. And even having a little checklist you have somewhere in your notebook of like weird sources of sepsis is worthwhile. And then all the sepsis mimics, right? Your toxicologic causes, your compartment syndrome with dead tissue, all of that is worth having a little mental primer to remember. Because yeah, you got to figure it out. If you're just going with, yeah, I don't know, they probably have a source somewhere. And look, I'm not throwing my brethren under the bus to say this, but that's what you could do in the emergency department. You could be like, it's probably sepsis, but it hasn't really shown yet. But once they get to the ICU, you no longer have that escape. I think it's really behooves you to figure out the source. Absolutely. All right. Hey folks, we're just going to stop for a second because this is a free episode. I'm giving it to you in its entirety, but it's very rare that we have these full free episodes because MCRIT is a members-only site that still has foam. But if you're enjoying this content, please consider becoming an MCRIT team member. It's inexpensive. You get CME. You could write it off on your taxes, but forget all that. What it's going to do is make you the best possible resuscitation and critical care doctor you could be. You'll have the most cutting-edge, up-to-date information, and you will get it in the comfort of your car or on the subway or while running, and you'll never have to think, am I current enough or not? Am I taking the best care of my critically ill patients? All right, let's get back to the show.
Elevated lactate does not mean fluid.
Yeah. And so I think that a common misconception, although I think it is getting better, is patients with persistently elevated lactate despite fluid resuscitation are just under-resuscitated and need more fluid. And I would conceptualize this that number one, two, and three is that maybe we don't have source control. So even in that patient with clear pneumonia, clear pneumosepsis, if we will, that on the chest x-ray, I think, does this patient need a CT scan to look for a paraneumonic effusion or lung ultrasound? That patient with cellulitis, could this be a necrotizing infection that needs debridement? The second thing I think of is, do we have the right etiology of shock? Again, not all septic shock is distributive. Is this a cold RV failure? Is there a pericardial effusion at play? And then the final thing is optimizing the microcirculation. And yes, some of these patients, it might be that they're hypovolemic and fluid responsive and need more fluid resuscitation. Could there be other therapies that we can offer the patient? Do they need an INO dilator? Do they need a MAP challenge? Do they need to be decongested, actually, if they have venous congestion? And so optimizing the microcirculation in some way, which could be fluids, could also be other therapy.
Yeah, I think we could go even a step further, that elevated lactate alone never equals the need for more fluid, by which I mean, you're never going to have isolated lactate as your only indicator of a patient who that's their issue. Because we're not just talking about being a little bit fluid down, which might have some impact on your blood pressure, what have you. We're talking about enough that you're actually now in anaerobic respiration at your cellular level, going to take and it's such a small subset of the hyperlactatemic patient that you shouldn't just regard lactate as an indicator of that. Now, of course, a patient who is radically hypovolemic or exsanguinating will have an elevated lactate, but there's going to be other signs. So I think I completely agree with you that it does not mean fluid, but I think we need to go a step further and make a positive statement that it not only doesn't indicate the need for more fluid in the sense of there's other reasons, but go a step further and just disconnect lactate entirely from fluid, because you're absolutely right. It has gotten better, but it's still out there. And I think the only way to counter what was a very negative message that was put forth in the early 2000s is to make a strong positive declaration that elevated lactate should never prompt fluid. And just never, just don't do it, which doesn't mean it won't be there sometimes when they need to get fluid administered. It means
oh, I see an elevated lactate. That's just not on the table. That's not it. Look, if you do cap refill and it's completely normal and they're elevated lactate, I think maybe look for other reasons than giving fluid, right? So it's just, I don't know what we have to do, because you're absolutely right. There are still holdouts out there that just no matter how much it's given, will just on the phone say, yeah, give another liter of fluid when they're, that lactate's reported. Okay. No such thing as a stable post-arrest patient.
Yeah, they just died. By definition, they're probably the patient in the hospital closest to being dead. I think sometimes we have a false sense of security. We've just pumped them full of B and they have tons of adrenergy flowing through their veins and their pressure looks great. Until we figure out the diagnosis, so we have lines and monitors and at least know what's going on with the patient, are at really high risk of dying again. And I think how I conceptualize this depends a little bit on what setting we're in, whether we're in a resuscitative setting like the trauma bay or operating room or intensive care unit, or whether this was a patient up on the ward that arrested. But if we're in a resuscitative setting, I view it like there's a little bit of a stay and play mentality. Let's at least figure our disposition from here. Are we going to the cath lab? Are we going to the CT scan or operating room because they're bleeding to death somewhere? And versus the ward, it might be more of a kind of scoop and run. Let's bring them down to the intensive care unit where we can then provide ongoing resuscitation and monitoring for the patient.
Yeah, I've often made the same comment that these are the sickest patients in your hospital at any given time, and they need to be given that respect. And oftentimes they're not. And it's why I've made the statements that I just don't think post-cardiac arrest patients should be in any of the smaller hospitals. This is a really, you need to be in a referral center that has all of the available radiologic, consultative capabilities to take care of these patients. And look, the patients whose trajectory and goals of care are not in aggressive curative, of course, yeah, and that's a perfect place for a community hospital. But we get these transfers 2 days in for post-arrest patients, and I just know it's not the physician's fault. It's not the nurse's fault. They're performing wonderfully. It's the capabilities of the medical center. And I just think cardiac arrest centers just need to happen, because there are so many specialized things that could occur in places that have high volume and that just can't in smaller shops. Absolutely, your comment is well taken in the hospital, in the individual hospital, but I think it has to be a systems approach to that same respect. All right. Cardiac arrest patients are simultaneously neuro, trauma, and cardiac patients.
I don't know if I heard this kind of on MCRIT first, so maybe I'm just reciting your rhetoric here, but and if it is, I entirely agree. First of all, somebody just hopped on their chest for about 30 minutes, crunching their chest. There's rib fractures. We know that they develop pneumothoraces, hematomas, splenic lacerations, liver lacerations, and understanding what injuries these patients have really influences down the road management. We're going to take a patient to the cath lab with a high-grade spleen injury. That may influence our decision to put somebody on antiplatelets or anticoagulation down the road. They're also a cardiac patient. Their heart just stopped, let's say, for a prolonged period of time, and they may have biventricular dysfunction, cardiac stunning, or even post-arrest vasoplegia. This is a very dynamic process. As somebody's metabolics get better post-arrest, their biventricular function might restore and they might become more vasoplegic. And so really staying on top of their physiology to ensure that we have adequate cardiac output, adequate MAP is super important. And then finally, they're a neuro patient. We care about their brain and we care about their neurologic recovery, and we want to do what we can to minimize secondary brain injury for these patients. And so sometimes just having framework that allows us to think about each of these three issues slightly separately, make sure that we're not missing anything overall.
Yeah, absolutely. This really requires a intensivist that has that broad-based knowledge set. I want them in a unit where the intensivist is really aligned with the complete complexity of this patient's multi-system problem. So I love that. All right. POCUS is telling you to give more fluids. You're probably using it wrong.
Yeah. I guess this comes from hearing sometimes clinicians say, oh, the IVC was very flat. I wanted to fill it up a little bit more. And I think this just really illustrates the fact that the decision to give fluids or any hemodynamic intervention does not come from any macrocirculatory parameter. It comes from really, in my mind, starting with the microcirculation. So is this patient having organ dysfunction as a result of, does this patient have abnormal cap refill time? Modeling, are they cold, altered mental status from their perfusion status? Are they oliguric with acute kidney injury? This is then coupled with a state of being fluid responsive, that they're actually going to increase their cardiac output, but then also fluid tolerant. And I think that point of care ultrasound is actually better probably at telling us about fluid tolerance or whether a patient's going to be harmed by giving additional IV fluids, as opposed to answering the question of fluid responsiveness. Yes, we can do passive leg raises with serial VTI. That's really cumbersome. I don't think that's actually a very scalable solution to most EDs and most intensive care units. I think in general, thinking, flipping it the other way and saying, does this patient have features that we shouldn't give fluids? I think that's a lot more accessible on ultrasound and potentially a better way to conceptualize how we should be using POCUS to guide fluid resuscitation.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. And thank you for going along with my same line, which is doing passive leg raising. It sounds wonderful as a demonstration of physiology to medical students once, but it's such an enormous pain in the butt to actually use as a continuous reassessment of fluid that I, when people talk about that in their papers, I'm like, are you really doing this at the bedside or are you just like pretending? Because it's such a pain in the butt. Now, people like Rory Spiegel, myself, some others, we've all gone with, okay, you could talk about everything you just spoke about, or you could just say, unless something is like pushing me so hard that like it's a completely different situation than we're normally dealing with, then they just don't need fluid after their initial resuscitation. You could obviate a lot of this. I'd say 98% of the time, I could just obviate this thought process by they don't need fluid because they're receiving all these meds. They probably have enough fluid unless they have an ongoing loss somewhere. So how much of this are you really thinking about, and how much are you saying, unless something's tipping off my spidey sense that they do need fluid, then maybe I'll do this complete investigation. So yeah, you could, every time a patient is hypotensive or you're called to the bedside by the nurses, oh, I think this patient needs some more fluid, you could go through a very complex set of cognitive steps and you can make all these determinations. And I think there are times you absolutely will do that. But for most of the time, if you just make the blanket assumption, the patient has no ongoing losses, they don't need fluid after their initial resuscitation, you will be right 98% of the time. So is it worth going through this complex cognitive gymnastics, or should you just go with the default, they don't need fluid, and then things that cue you differently, oh, this is an anomaly, then maybe do this complex investigation?
Yeah, I think that's entirely the right way to go. I think most patients, it's really clear whether or not they need fluid or not. And I think the answer for most of those is no. I think there is a subset of patients, a post-surgical patient that has cardiomyopathy at baseline. They have some volume losses. They're getting worse. Their organ perfusion, their lactate's rising. They have poor cap refill time. All of that's getting worse. And you're thinking, right, is this patient hypovolemic? Despite the fact that on POCUS, their stroke volume is low and their EF is low. Maybe that patient actually still requires fluid because they're fluid responsive. Those are some of the nuanced situations where I think that these maneuvers are helpful. But I agree. I don't think that repeating VTI serially is actually very durable as a solution. And there's also a lot of variability. So even the same provider repeating VTI, there's a 10 to 15% variability. So unless we're seeing pretty significant changes in the VTI, angle, patient positioning can really influence the measurements that we're getting.
Absolutely. Let's go a step further into the Andromeda 2 stuff since you have familiarity with it. If the patient has perfect cap refill, is that just a stop point? Can you just stop there for the need for fluid? And if they don't, okay, now maybe I'll do some more investigations, because it's an easily available bedside trigger to say whatever's going on with this patient right now, their cardiac output, given their hemodynamic milieu, seems to be okay. What's your thoughts on that?
I think that the answer is yes. I think that perhaps it's an oversimplification. And are there cases where cap refill time alone is not adequate to assess microcirculation? Probably yes. There could be other markers of microcirculatory dysfunction. Perhaps the patient's mottled, perhaps that they have oliguria with kind of rising creatinine. But I think the general philosophy that if the microcirculation is intact, what's the point of trying to optimize it? Or you can't get better than normal, sort of thing. And anything else is then just exposing somebody to the harms of IV fluids without the potential benefit.
And now, last but not least, when a family or patient says they want everything done, it is rarely life at all costs, but rather that they don't want you to give up on them.
Yeah. We hear this a lot, that maybe a colleague, maybe even the family says, we want everything done. And sometimes if we take that at face value, I think we're really not actually understanding what the patient values. And so taking it just that step further and saying, what does that actually mean to you? And when you really dive into it, I think it means that patients want to be diagnosed. They want to have treatment for reversible causes. Often, if a patient's dying despite everything we're doing, they want to have a natural, they want to have a dignified death, and really understanding what is important to them if they were dying. I think sometimes we say, what would you want? And when you ask somebody what they want, it implies that it's a possibility. Scott, do you want me to buy you a Ferrari? Hell yeah, let's do it. But I'm not going to offer you that because that's not actually feasible. And so when we actually go into it and say, you know what, your loved one is dying or you are dying right now, and I don't think we can fix this, what's most important to you? I think many patients will say that having a comfortable, peaceful, natural death surrounded by family and having that dignity is really important to them.
Yeah. And I think that's the perfect place to finish because it's so important and so critical. It's one of the key tasks to a resuscitation doctor or a critical care doctor is the capability of having these conversations in a way that is inviting and allows the family to leave the room saying that doctor understood what we wanted, that doctor cared about what we wanted, and we came to a consensus that made everyone happy versus, wow, I don't think he heard a word I said. And those are the family members that are going to be disgruntled, that are not going to necessarily comport with what you feel the plan of care is ideally going towards. Yeah, it's a shame. Like, you really need to have the capability in intensive care of aggressive movement to high-level resuscitation, to being able to handle emergencies, to be able to handle chaos. And yet at the same time, you have to be this incredibly open, caring conversationalist. It's really asking a lot. I think it's why it's hard sometimes to find that balance, but you need it. Now, do you think that's trainable, Russ? What you're at the beginning of your career, you come up with a lot of people who are just now entering into their professions, and some of them, you were with them in medical school, you were with them in residency, and you're like, oh my God, this person can't talk to patients at all. Do you think they have a path to be able to develop those skills if they didn't have them innately?
Absolutely. And I think really this comes from having mentorship and seeing people have these conversations and having a discussion with your mentors about these conversations. And certainly I was really fortunate to have many mentors that were incredible at these end-of-life care conversations and really understanding patient values. And certainly that's how I learned. And I'm not going to say that I was the most naturally gifted person at these conversations. And I think just through iterative reflection and having a bit of an interest in really improving this part of our care and recognizing the importance of it, as you say, I think anyone can really develop expertise in these skills. So yeah.
All right, fantastic. We've come to the end of our list. I'm sure many more will be forthcoming. If you keep putting out these tweets, we will have to have you back on to talk about. Is this going to be your main thrust of your medical education? Is through Twitter?
Yeah, certainly continuing the FOMED discussion on Twitter. I'm working on a platform, Simple Sage, which is more designed for clinicians and researchers to really innovate around novel research methods. So that's something that I've been working on in the background and hoping to continue on. And just, yeah, seeing where I can go as a investigator, educator, and just hugely grateful to the FOMED community in general for the contributions throughout my medical training from before med school when I was a paramedic and now early on in my career. So just thankful for the space and for everyone's contributions.
I love it. All right. What's your Twitter handle so people can go follow you?
Ross_Prager.
There we go. All right, man. Can't thank you enough for coming on.
Thanks, Scott.
You hate that sound. I hate that sound. Why are you hearing that sound? You're hearing that sound because you are a unpaid listener to MCRIT, and yet this is one of those episodes where only the team members, the MCRIT members, get the full episode, which means you're missing out on tons of resuscitative goodness. You're missing out on the optimal way to care for your super sick patients. And it's sad because just going to mcrit.org/join would allow you to get full access, to get access to the RAC literature reviews, full episodes, extra goodies, bonus stuff for an incredibly inexpensive price. Your department will pay for it, or you could write it off on your taxes. You could get it done before the end of the year and become a full MCRIT member. Just go on over to mcrit.org/join, and you will now be someone exposed to all of the information to take care of your super sick patients that you want. You'll get this full episode and be able to actually perform a retrograde intubation. You'll be happy. So just go on over to mcrit.org/join and never hear this message again.